like a Jewish leader, but I think from what I was able to uncover, I think that is being confused with a different Hosea, another person with his father's name. The name of Hosea means salvation. It also could be interpreted as he saves or he helps. It is thought that he lived in a town called Belamoth in the tribe of Issachar. This meant that he lived in the kingdom of what we later would be told was the kingdom of Samaria. Now, just as people who think of the different messages that the minor prophets delivered, Hosea is often seen as a prophet of doom. But that's really not a fair statement, because while yes, it is, he does preach a lot of doom, he provides the path to escape that doom, or if not to escape it, provides hope that'll allow them to overcome and escape this judgment that is going to be coming upon them. We read that he prophesied under the kings of Judah that were Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. Now, in the king of Israel at the time, we were told, was Jeroboam the second. If he prophesied in the reign of all these princes, he must have lived a fairly long time. Now, I know I was told when I took this job there would be no math, but I'd have a little bit of math to share with you. If he the reign of all four of those kings was 112 years. If you take the assumption, well, Uzziah began in AD 3194, and Hezekiah's reign ended 3194. Oh, I'm sorry, I've got some typos in there. I'll stay away from the ADs. Assuming that Hosea was in his 20s when he began to prophesy, that would make this total almost about 127 years, if you kind of guesstimate 25 years or so. But if you would take, 10 years into the reign of Uzziah, and maybe he died 10 years into the reign of Hezekiah, he probably was around at least 107 years old, most people believe. And so just to give you an idea that he was one of the oldest, if not the oldest, prophets in the Old Testament. Hosea was written in the period covered from 2 Kings chapter 14 through chapter 18, and this is prior to the destruction of Israel by Assyria. This makes Hosea a contemporary of Isaiah. Now, Isaiah wrote mostly for southern Judah, and Hosea's remarks are directed toward northern Israel. And another prophet at this time that was prophesying in Israel was Amos. I talked about Amos just on a regular Sunday sermon back at the end of the year. Hosea, as I said, he lived in northern Israel, and Israel is often called Ephraim, after the name of the tribe where the capital, was found, not unlike how Judah is, the southern kingdom is called Judah, based upon one of the tribes. And this prophecy does cover the last 40 years of Israel's history. As I mentioned, he was prophesying under Jeroboam the second's reign, but during that reign, Assyria would gain strength and overtake them. Now, the story itself is a story of Hosea and his wife Gomer. This is an illustration. I looked this up. It really is an allegory. The first three chapters of this book are a story of the relationship of Hosea and Gomer's marriage and the troubles that develop in that marriage. And then the last remaining 11 chapters really talk about how this story translates and is a reflection of the history of the northern tribes, the relationship that Israel had with God. Their holiness was contrasted with the corruption that was there. There, so as I mentioned, there were two main divisions, the first three chapters, and then 4 through 14. So let's look at the first three chapters. This is a personal story of Hosea. Now, in chapter 1, verse 2, we're told that God specifically tells him to marry. And he is told to marry a harlot, a prostitute. We are told that there are three children. The first is a son named Jezreel, which means God scatters. That's found in chapter 14, verse 5. Now, depending upon what version you're reading, King James and the English Standard, which is our Pew Bible, they have different translations here. The second child they had was a daughter. The King James says her name is Loruhama. I'm probably not saying that anywhere close to being correct. But the English Standard says that her name was No Mercy. I have to think that's a translation of the name that's given in King James. And then there was a son named Loami. And in the English Standard, it says that his name means not my people. That's found in verse 9. Now, while the first is called Hosea's son, we're never officially told that the last two children were Hosea's. Just because of the nature of Gomer, that is easy to be understood that that might not be the case. So, while this is a book of gloom and doom, I do want to focus on verses 10 and 11 of chapter 1. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, "You are not my people," it shall be said to them, "Children of the living God." And the children of Judah and the children of Israel shall be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head, and they shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. So they're told, even with all this destruction, they're not going to be totally destroyed. They're not going to be, you know, they're not going to cease to exist. They will have a future. There will be multiple generations coming from this. So as we get into chapter 2, Hosea talks about how Gomer is like Israel. The charge has been made that Gomer is committing adultery and that some of her children are the result of adultery. God made her life difficult so that she would not have, I suppose, good relations with these other gentlemen with whom she is committing adultery. Verse 6 and 7 of chapter 2 of Hosea said that she would decide to return to her husband, and she had forgotten from where her blessings had come. And verse 14, we read that she would be punished, but then God would restore. And we go down to verse 23 of chapter 2. It says, "And I will sow her for myself in the land, and I will have mercy on no mercy. And I will say to not my people, 'You are my people.' And he shall say, 'You are my God.'" A restoration is going to take place here in her relationship with Hosea. And then in chapter 3, this is about the restoration of Gomer. The marriage is restored. In chapter 1, verse 3, we read, "Go, and the Lord said to me, 'Go again, love a woman who is loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins.'" Dropping down to verse 5, it says, "Afterward the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God, and David their king, and they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days." The end result is that she would return to Hosea, and just like the children of Israel, there would be a reconciliation between the two of them. So, as I mentioned, the first three chapters are this story between Hosea and Gomer. And now, that story, with that in mind, we now can transfer that thought to the relationship of the northern tribes with God. Chapters 4 and 5 of Hosea talk, just like the adultery that Gomer committed, these chapters talk about the adultery that Israel is committing. If we look at chapter 4, the first two verses says, "Hear the word of the Lord, O children of Israel, for the Lord has a controversy with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or steadfast love, and no knowledge of God in the land. There is swearing, lying, murder, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and bloodshed follows bloodshed. They have totally lost their way. They are not devoted to the God that had brought their ancestors out of the land of Egypt and delivered them into this land. They have totally forgotten God. Verse 6 of chapter 4 indicates that they find themselves in a situation because of this condition. Verse 6 says, "My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I reject you from being a priest to me. And since you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children." Now the rest of chapter 4 and most of chapter 5 then talks about how their sinning led them into a state. It said their sin fed upon each other. Sin gets to a point where that sin might get boring, and so they go looking for better ways to sin. You know, I've used this phrase a few times. You know, the devil is always helping people find bigger and better ways. They have top men working on sin. And that's what was happening here. They would sin, and then that would feed upon their desire to sin further and sin more in greater actions. And so it got to the point where they were not even thinking or considering of God at all anymore. Because of their actions and their attitude, verse 14 and 15 of chapter 5 says that Israel would be destroyed, and this was being done so they could learn a lesson. "For I will be like a lion to Ephraim, and like a young lion to the house of Judah. I, even I, will tear and go away. I will carry off, and no one shall rescue. I will return again to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face, and in their distress earnestly seek me." Chapters 6 through 8 then cover their refusal to repent. If we go to chapter 6, I'll read the first three verses. "Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn us, that he may heal us. He has struck us down, and he will bind us up. After 2 days, he will revive us. On the third day, he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going out is sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers, as the spring rains that water the earth." But as has happened in the past, any attempt for them to right themselves is not very long lasting. If you go down to Hosea chapter 7, I'm going to read verses 13 through 16. "Woe to them, for they have strayed from me. Destruction to them, for they have rebelled against me. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me. They do not cry to me from the heart, but they wail upon their beds. For grain and wine they gash themselves. They rebel against me. Although I trained and strengthened their arms, yet they devise evil against me. They return, but not upward. They are like a treacherous bough. Their princes shall fall by the sword because of the insolence of their tongue. This shall be their derision in the land of Egypt." And so because of this, we find, a lengthy passage I'm going to read here, the first 10 verses of chapter 8, they are going to be sent to Assyria. "Set the trumpet to your lips. One like a vulture is over the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. To me they cry, 'My God, we, Israel, know you. Israel has spurned the good, the enemy shall pursue him. They made kings, but not through me. They set up princes, but I knew it not. With their silver and gold they made idols for their own destruction. I have spurned your calf, O Samaria. My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? For it is from Israel. A craftsman made it. It is not God. The calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. For they sow the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads. It shall yield no flour. If it were to yield, strangers would devour it. Israel is swallowed up. Already they are among the nations as a useless vessel. For they have gone up to Assyria, a wild donkey wandering alone. Ephraim has hired lovers. Though they hire allies among the nations, I will soon gather them up, and the king and princes shall soon rise because of the tribute. So they tried to do things on their own, tried to do things their own way. They tried to build up idols. They tried to sow, and they weren't going to be able to reap what they wanted. They said even if the grain would bloom, someone else was going to be eating it, not them. They weren't going to profit from anything that they were attempting to do away from God's providence. Chapters 9 and 10 of Hosea then records the judgment by God. Chapter 9, verse 3 says that Israel is going to be dispersed. They shall not remain in the land of the Lord, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean food in Assyria. Chapter 9, 11 through 12 says, Ephraim's glory shall fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. Even if they bring up children, I will bereave them till none is left. Woe to them when I depart from them. And the idols that they've built up for themselves are discussed in chapter 10, verses 5 through 6. The inhabitants of Samaria tremble for the calf of Beth-Aven. Its people mourn for it, and so do its idolatrous priests, those who rejoiced over it and over its glory. For it is departed from them. The thing itself shall be carried to Assyria as tribute to the great king. Ephraim shall be put to shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his idol. And just as had been touched in chapter 8, they're going to reap what they've sown. They're going to realize the benefit or the product of their actions. In verses 13 through 15 there in Hosea 10, you have plowed iniquity, you have reaped injustice, you have eaten the fruit of lies. Because you have trusted in your own way and in the multitude of your warriors, therefore the tumult of war shall rise among your people. And all your fortresses shall be destroyed, as Shalman destroyed Beth Arbel on the day of battle. Mothers were dashed in pieces with their children. Thus it shall be done to you, O Bethel, because of your great evil. At dawn the king of Israel shall be utterly cut off. Finally, the last three chapters deal with the restoration of Israel. In the first four verses of chapter 11, just think about your own relationship with God and how we're not unlike Israel. But God cared for them, and it's told here in these first four verses, and he cares for us as well. When Israel was a child, I loved him, and out of Egypt I called my son. The more they were called, the more they went away. They kept sacrificing to the Baals and burning offerings to idols. Yet it was I who taught Ephraim to walk. I took them up by their arms, but they did not know that I healed them. I led them with cords of kindness, with the bands of love, and I became to them as one who eases the yoke on their jaws, and I bent down to them and fed them. He always cared for them. But chapter 11, verse 7 talks about how they were bent on sin, and this thought concludes in chapter 13, verses 4 through 9, that they were the cause of their own destruction. There was no other reason why they were being punished than what they had done. But I am the Lord your God from the land of Egypt. You know no God but me, and besides me there is no Savior. It was I who knew you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. But when they had grazed, they became full. They were filled, and their heart was lifted up. Therefore they forgot me. So I am to them like a lion. Like a leopard, I will lurk beside the way. I will fall upon them like a bear robbed of her cubs. I will tear open their breast, and there I will devour them like a lion, as a wild beast would rip them open. He destroys you, O Israel, for you are against me, against your helper. But then despite all this, the last chapter concludes with the Lord being willing to take them back. If we look at the first four verses of the last chapter, 14. Return, O Israel, to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take with you words and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity, accept what is good, and we will pay with bulls the vows of our lips. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride on horses, and we will say no more, our God, to the work of our hands. In you the orphan finds mercy. I will heal their apostasy. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned from them. So this final chapter of this book is really the lesson that we can take, you know, the lesson that we can apply to us today is found here. If you look at the ninth verse of chapter 14, whoever is wise, let him understand these things. Whoever is discerning, let him know them. For the ways of the Lord are right, and the upright walk in them, but transgressors stumble in them. That message is no different then as it is today. It's our responsibility to know what's expected of us, and it's for us to know his ways, and we should have the faith that we know that what he's put out in front of us as far as to follow is right. It's for our best. And if we walk upright in them, we will complete our journey. But if we don't choose to follow them, we're going to stumble and not complete that journey. Despite their grave and continual sinning, God still was there for the land of Israel. Same with us. If we continue to sin, God will not take, you know, he's not going to refuse to take us back if we realize that he's where we need to be. And that is a great and valuable lesson that the book provides to us. But I want to close with just one thing. Just Hosea himself, I mean, what a sacrifice that he made on a personal level to serve God. I'm sure Hosea's first choice for a wife wasn't Gomer or a woman like her. And he's gladly followed the commandment of the Lord. And I'm sure he was heartbroken when this woman, you know, he knew what type of woman she was, but I'm sure he thought that he could turn her away from that activity. And I'm sure his heart broke when she then went on and committed adultery despite the marriage that she had entered into. But then think about how heartbroken the Lord is when we have entered into a relationship with the God freely. We weren't told, like Hosea, to go and you know, enter into this relationship. For those of us here who are Christians, we've entered in freely to this marriage, this relationship with God. And when we sin, we're committing adultery against that commitment. And just as we can easily see how Hosea was probably heartbroken, we have to see that from the other side, God is heartbroken for us whenever we depart from him. And such a lesson that we find here that brings it down to really a personal level. You know, we think of God being this omnipotent, powerful being, but his heart aches and breaks for us when sin takes place. He is no different than Hosea being heartbroken for the actions of Gomer. At this time, before we pause for our class, we'll ask Brother Bragg to lead us in a word of prayer, and then we will go to our classes.